Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Today's program has been brought to you by Heritage Foods USA, the nation's largest distributor of heritage breed pigs and turkeys. For more information, visit heritagefoodsusa.com. On behalf of our family of hosts, staff, and the millions of listeners who have tuned in since 2009, we want to wish you happy holidays and ask for your support as we launch our daily in-house news coverage. Please consider making us a part of your end-of-year giving in 2013. Your membership donation is tax deductible and the best way to show you believe in our work and the importance of a free, food-focused media resource. Consider donating today at heritageradionetwork.org by clicking the donate button. Thanks for your support and enjoy the show.
Hi, and welcome to A Taste of the Past. I'm your host, Linda Palaccio. And today, as we make some of our final preparations for the Christmas season, I thought it only fitting to talk about what we attribute all our fanciful meals to, or who we attribute them to, and where those traditions came from. And it's really somewhat of, I think, a mystery to a lot of people that the way the Christmas dinners, as we know them, the special occasions with all the fanciful stuffed turkeys or big joints of meat and all the puddings, if you're in England, the steaming puddings and the Christmas puddings, really were something that were celebrated quite a long time ago, but then were banned or actually abolished for many years. And it wasn't until Charles Dickens wrote a tale remembering Christmases of his past and sort of reincarnated the Christmas dinner and the Christmas spirit, as he calls it, along with the help of Queen Victoria, I would imagine, bringing that into play. And he really, after that, then this book, A Christmas Dinner, that he wrote is a sweet little story. And he wrote that in 1935. And it wasn't until some years later that he published A Christmas Carol, which, of course, was the book that seemed to clinch it all for people as far as the family Christmas celebrations. Somebody who has done quite a bit of research in this, and in fact has done research through all the ages of recreating dinners and menus and recipes, and contributed to a book, A Christmas Dinner, story by Charles Dickens, is culinary historian Alice Ross. Alice has received her PhD in food history, did her dissertation on food history at Stony Brook, and for over 30 years she has been dedicated to teaching people about recreating historic recipes, and in fact has turned her home in Smithtown, New York, into a studio open with a 19th century studio with a 10-foot open hearth and an open brick bake oven, and for many years gave classes to people, instructing them on open hearth cooking techniques and the recipes. I mean, she's done classes on everything from Greek, Roman, and beyond, all the way up through the Middle Ages and on to modern early 19th century recipes, as you know, when people started making chicken salad, I guess you could say. So it is with great pleasure that I welcome Alice to help bring us through the recipes and the menu that would have been a Dickens Christmas. Alice, welcome.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
When Alice, I said that your kitchen is a replica of a 19th, or not a replica, it's a renovation and restoration of a 19th century kitchen. Is that correct?
It's really 18th century.
18th, oh, okay.
Right.
Oh, the house was built in 17, right?
Pardon?
When was the house was built in the 1700s?
My home was built in the middle 1800s.
Mm-hmm.
My house is an old house, but the garage out and back, which was a big two-car garage originally, has been converted into being a cooking studio, and that now has a brick floor and brick shell and wooden shelves all around, and has all kinds of antique, usable cooking pots, and a big fireplace.
Well, some people have some people have likened it to a museum. Actually,
it is. It is a museum,
but a working museum, correct?
Yes.
Yeah,
that's right.
And your son is a talented blacksmith, I read, and he's made many of the tools that you use in your kitchen.
That's true.
Interesting. That's great. Well, bring us along a little bit about, I mean, I know that people celebrated, well, Christmas, winter solstice has been celebrated forever, right, in pagan times. But then by the 4th century, there were Christmas celebrations on this day. And can you tell us a little bit about the background of Christmas celebrations?
Well, I don't think that they... well, let me start by saying that the earliest Christmas celebration had its roots in Druidic practices,
mm-hmm.
because it was celebrating the midwinter return of the lengthening day.
Right.
Its icons were the Yule log, the boar's head, holly, ivy, mistletoe, and feasting. By the Middle Ages, the boiled Christmas pudding and mince pies had put in their appearance, and the celebration continued, although more in the halls of the wealthy than the hovels of the poor, until Cromwell's 17th century revolt and the Puritans turning away from religious pageantry. The Anglican return brought with it some of the earlier festivities, but they were generally doomed under the weight of growing cities, manufacturing, changes in agricultural communities, and the strict class differences, and they were fading out by the beginning of the 19th century. For many, Christmas meant a normal work day, perhaps observed by attending a church service, but with very little home celebration.
And this was true even in early America. It was just a regular work day, right?
Mm. That's true. There was no special dinner. There were no gifts. There were no decorations. The earlier practices of presenting the boar's head, the mistletoe, the holly, and the ivy had declined and largely disappeared. However, Queen Victoria, deeply in love with her German husband, Prince Albert, and desirous of pleasing him, instituted the German holiday of his childhood at the British court in the early 1840s.
Well, and in fact, that's where the Christmas tree comes from, or
that's
from
right.
German celebrations,
that's
right?
Yeah. That's right, along with the stockings, the decorations, gifts, and food, notably feasting, cookies, special puddings, cakes, and candies.
Mm.
At about the same time, Charles Dickens, remembering the gala events of his own early 19th century childhood, Christmas Day, at the home of his grandparents, undertook to restore the nature of the English 18th century holiday, a kind of a homecoming party and a gathering of the family fold. He published a short story called A Christmas Dinner in 1835 that was to become the basis for his Christmas Carols dinner and the model for the traditional Christmas Day feast.
Well, it was around this time, too, that Washington Irving wrote some stories influenced by Dutch settlers, too, melding the St. Nicholas
mm-hmm.
traditions and the English tradition of the past English traditions of celebrating into kind of a what is now like a wintry celebration of nostalgia, someone said, right?
Right, that's right.
So between these two, it's interesting, between these two popular writers, things came together.
That's true.
Hmm. Well, the White House first celebrated, I think I found some dates that the White House first had a Christmas tree and a Christmas celebration in 1923, and the first tree went up in Rockefeller Center in New York City in 1931. So it's really quite recent that we, you know, that all these celebrations have taken place.
It's true.
Hmm. Well, tell me, you, in this book, it's a recent publication, I think 2008.
Yes.
Right. It is a recent version of Charles Dickens' A Christmas Dinner. And it contains a foreword by Peter Ackroyd. So for those of you who are not aware, he's the foremost living biographer of Charles Dickens. And the recipes and the foreword and stories of the food and culinary practices are all by Alice Ross. So, Alice, you talk about both the Christmas Eve celebration and the Christmas Day celebration. So, Christmas Eve celebration, tell us a little bit about that.
Well, Christmas Eve was the time that the servants and the masters came together and celebrated. There was absolutely no distinction in class at this time.
So it really was a time of good cheer, right?
It really was. They had, I've made some notes.
I know they drank a lot at the Christmas Eve celebration.
Oh, they did. Sure. They had wassail punch. This would be a typical dinner, a typical Christmas Eve celebration. They would have wassail, which you know about.
Yes, it's good health, good the wassail,
right.
And we sing to it, right?
Right. And it would have beer or ale and bread and it, and spices and sometimes egg. And you would drink it from a wooden bowl, and people were not worrying about germs then, and so they would pass the bowl around.
Hmm.
And there were beautiful, beautifully carved bowls that the wealthy had in gorgeous hard woods.
I was interested to see, too, in your recipe for the wassail punch in the book, it contains small baked apples as well.
Right, that's right.
Wonderful. Yeah.
Hot. They would be hot roasted apples, and they would be put into the punch, and it would and they would sizzle as they fell in.
Mm.
they were wonderful, but they would be little apples, like little lady apples.
Mm-hmm.
And then they would also have scalloped oysters and chicken pies. Chicken pie was a very fancy dish in those days. Carrots in their own juice, potatoes and turnips buttered and mashed together, bread and butter and mincemeat tarts. And mincemeat, you know, would have been made with venison.
Yeah, right.
Probably.
Right. Now, it's interesting. It's something that I think Americans, I don't know, you would know to tell me, they shied away from adding the sugar and meat in pies and making true mincemeat with the, you know, the dried fruits and lots of sugar and beef or venison and a lot of animal fat. What?
Right.
Why do you think this practice did not continue in modern cooking?
Well, people were kind of taken aback by having meat in their fruit pies. I think we became kind of finicky.
Hmm.
And besides which, we didn't make our own mincemeat. We bought it in jars.
Yeah. And of course, the wealthy would have ordered their pies from the bakery in England, right?
So that's true.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's interesting. Sidney Mintz, in his book on sugar, made comment about the puddings and the mincemeats and the English's affinity for sweets, lots of sugar.
Yes. Yes.
So,
and molasses, too.
Right, treacle, molasses.
Right.
Hmm, interesting. And maybe the more austere American diets just couldn't handle both. Right? It's either or, not both together.
Well, Americans were English.
Yeah, true.
And they pretty much followed the English patterns, if they were wealthy enough. But if they weren't wealthy enough, then they made do with what they had.
Mm. And that's certainly, a mincemeat pie is certainly a pie of abundance.
That's true.
Yeah. Well, the evening, this is the Christmas Eve evening, that always ended with another drink. Interesting. And
yes.
That would be, what would that be?
hot mulled elderberry wine.
Elderberry wine. Mm, yes. And with spices in it again?
Yes.
As it heats up, it fills the house with all the odors of what we, you know, relate to
right.
Christmas.
right.
Yeah. Well, then, of course, I mean, no one can forget the image of the plays, the movies, the illustrations in the books of you know, Bob Cratchit's family finally sitting down when Scrooge brings over the goose and sitting down to a wonderful dinner. And we're going to take a short break. When we come back, we're going to talk all about A Christmas Dinner.
Good.
You're listening to Favorite Flower by Pamela Royal on heritageradionetwork.org.
Today's program has been brought to you by Heritage Foods USA, the world's largest distributor of heritage breed pork and turkeys. With the holidays approaching, we've introduced new gift ideas, including cuts from a variety of rare heritage breeds. What better gift to share than a meal that will be remembered forever? To order our gift packages or create custom gifts for friends and family, visit heritagefoodsusa.com.
We are back on A Taste of the Past, and I've been speaking with Alice Ross. Alice Ross is a culinary historian and a food historian and a living history interpreter, if you will. And you've just whetted my appetite with a Christmas Eve dinner, Alice. Let's move on to what Dickens describes as his Christmas dinner menu. Now, before we do, I have to say a bit about him and his wife, Catherine Hogarth. I mean, both of them were really interested in food, from what I've read. And of course, he did a grand tour of Europe, or in parts, didn't really like the food of other parts. He loved his English food. But they both were interested in food and cooking.
Yes, they were. And they cooked together. They opened their home to friends and family often. They both did marketing. They had a splendid Christmas dinner, and they brought back the tradition, I would say. They invented the menus. They fussed over the recipes and they cooked. although Catherine did some or all of the cooking, she employed a cook and the kitchen staff from 1838 onwards who prepared the daily meals and assisted in numerous dinner parties.
Well, I read, I think it was in your notes that you included in the book, that she actually, under a pseudonym, published a cookbook called...
Yes, Lady Clutterbucks. What Shall We Have for Dinner, it was called.
Interesting. And you included one of the recipes in a facsimile of the Christmas dinner, right?
Yes.
The kakaliki soup?
Right, right.
Interesting. All right, so talk to me about the Christmas dinner.
Well, the menu, first of all, was punch, which would have been wine and... sometimes brandy as well, with oranges and lemons sliced into it, and a little sugar. Mm. Kakaliki soup, which would have been chicken soup, made with leeks. They would have had cod with oyster sauce.
Now, that sounds very elaborate in today's world, but oysters were really quite plentiful then, right?
Yes, they were. I mean, you could go down to the Thames and pick them up.
Mm-hmm. And in New York, they were on every street corner, so...
Right, right. That's true. They had lamb or mutton roasted with celery sauce. Hmm. They might have had turkey, which was common then. Even though we think of turkey as an American bird, it was brought over to Europe and propagated there. And it replaced the goose in many cases because they were easier to breed and raise.
And you could get a larger roast, right? A large turkey. The geese don't
with
really...
With more meat.
Right.
That's right. You get much more meat from a turkey than you do from a goose.
Even though we know Scrooge brought a goose to the table.
Well, that was before turkey, I guess. And that would have been stuffed with forcemeat, which is kind of like a sausage mixture. They had roast beef with horseradish sauce. They had colcannon, which was a mixture of vegetables, cabbage and potatoes.
Right. Now, that we know from Irish cuisine, a colcannon, but this would be more like a form, like a pudding form, or...
It would be molded in a form, something mm-hmm. like a melon mold, if you know what they are.
Mm-hmm. So it would be around, the vegetables would all be molded and...
Molded in stripes.
Cooked. Nice.
Probably. Mm. If it was a fancy meal.
Mm-hmm.
Scalloped potatoes, which would have been in a cream sauce. Baked beetroot, which would have been... possibly with vinegar and sugar, stewed chestnuts, pickled mushrooms, rolls and butter. And then for dessert.
Right. I think I need an hour to digest. Right?
Pardon?
I said I would need an hour to digest, yes.
Right, that's true. Well, there might have been a time between the main meal and the dessert. When the people would get up and walk around and maybe hear some music in the garden or something,
mm-hmm.
and then come back. And the table, in the meantime, would have been cleared, and then the desserts would have been put out. And they would have had orange and lemon jello,
which would have been
made with calf's foot jello.
Yeah, that surprised me that they liked a gelatin. Now, did they use that as a palate cleanser, or was it, it certainly wasn't necessarily a sweet dessert?
It was a dessert, but it was certainly a cleanser.
Mm.
But then the remaining desserts were very rich. Mince pie or tarts and Christmas pudding.
Now, we want to elaborate on the Christmas pudding, but go on, and then we'll go back to the Christmas pudding.
And Christmas cake, which would have been any kind of cake that had draped marzipan sheets over it.
Hmm. Wonderful.
Christmas pudding would have been a mixture of breadcrumbs and apples and nuts and raisins and dried fruits mixed with egg and wine, brandy, and poured into a big sheet of muslin, which was then gathered up on all corners and tied around the top so that very tight, so that heavy butcher's twine, so that the water would not get in. And then it would be suspended into a big cauldron of boiling water and boiled.
Now, would
for
this,
several hours.
Would this, at that time, would this have been done on, they had the Victorian stove in kitchens, of course, at this time, but would this have been done in the open hearth, perhaps?
It could have been, yes. Or it could have been done on a wood range.
And then, of course, it would be brought to the table. After it was steamed, and removed from the muslin, what would go on then?
Then it would be cooled before it was unwrapped so that it wouldn't fall apart. And then it would be served on a big platter, decorated with holly leaves.
And then the coup de grace would be...
hard sauce.
And it would it be brought to the table flaming, generally?
Yes, it would, with hot brandy.
Mm-hmm. Wonderful. I mean, the scenes you see of them, you know, them walking in with the flaming Christmas pudding and everyone cheers, like, you know.
Right.
That's
turn
great.
The lights out. They blew out all the candles and carried in this blazing pudding.
Now, you mentioned mincemeat pie, okay, and Christmas pudding, both of these containing dried currants and raisins, you know, maybe plums.
And apples.
Yeah, okay. Well, a lot, but then these fruits did not come packaged the way we know them today.
No.
So you mentioned...
You made your own mincemeat.
And you mentioned...
And you often made it weeks in advance and let it age.
Oh, even better. But you mentioned that, because it appears in Dickens' story, that the children were busy all day stoning plums.
Stoning what?
Stoning plums. Meaning raisins or any dried
raisins, yeah. Right.
So they would put the kids to work. You had to take the seeds out of all this fruit, all the dried fruit, right?
That's true.
Yeah, gives the kids a job to do.
Right.
And it's interesting, you included a little tidbit, sort of maybe where a lot of you know, we know that in a lot of European countries, one eats salad and cheese at the end of the meal. But Dickens had a particular pleasure, and what was that?
Well, he had salad and cheese at the end of the meal. The cheese was kind of like a what's the word? Like a fondue, like
an English rabbit, an English rarebit, or rabbit.
Rabbit. That's
right.
The word.
Right. So it would be toasted, what they would call toasted cheese, but it was really now what we know of as English rarebit or rabbit, right?
Right. And it could have been Stilton cheese, or it could have been a good aged cheddar.
Hmm. So it was baked or toasted in a wine or in a port?
Yeah.
Hmm. And then served with bits of toast?
Right.
Well, he certainly ate well at Christmas.
Well, he did. He was probably middle class. The upper middle class, I would say. And they could afford all these things.
Mm. Well, the puddings, I want to go back to the Christmas pudding particularly, and the mincemeat. This was a traditional type of pudding. Even back in Markham Gervaise's housewifery book, you know, from the 1500s, he gives recipes for marrow puddings and you know, at least not, if not meat in the pudding, some type of suet or marrow, as I said. So this is a practice that goes back quite a ways.
I think it must be an ancient dish.
Yeah, I guess it's sort of enforced. You're going to have one meal, get it all in one dish, right?
Right.
Hmm, interesting. Well, Alice, you have taught classes in all of this, as I said earlier at the top of the show. And what I also wanted to mention is that you are one of the co-founders of the Culinary Historians of New York. And that is an organization that is still alive and well today, and I thank you for helping found that, and I thank you for all your work. You've brought so many. You've been a consultant to the historic Williamsburg and so many different areas about the food of the past, and I thank you for all your research and your work. For this book and these recipes, was there Was there someone in particular of that period that you relied heavily on, that we know of today, a cookbook author?
Well, I made some notes. I can find them. Yes, here they are. I actually used Lady Maria Clutterbuck's What Shall We Have for Dinner?
Going right to the source. Going right to the source, Charles Dickens' wife.
Right, yeah. Right. And Dinner for Dickens, A Culinary History of Mrs. Charles Dickens' Menu Books, which was printed in Britain in 1988.
Hmm.
Eliza Acton.
Oh, yes.
Who wrote, you know her book?
Yes.
1845.
Mm-hmm.
Kitchener, a lady, new London domestic cookery, adapted to the use of private families in London, 1838. Mrs. Beaton, you know Mrs. Beaton,
course.
I'm sure.
Of course.
And Mrs. Dickens' recipe collection.
Interesting. These are all, and these, Eliza Acton certainly, and A Lady, the New London Cookery, these were all books of the period during that time that The Christmas Dinner was written.
That's right.
What I like so much about the recipes that you included in this, it's a cute little book. At the front, it looks like a children's book, almost, it really is packed with a lot of history. Yes, it contains Dickens' short little Christmas dinner story, but it really is packed with a lot of information about the food and dining practice of the time. What I liked about your recipes that you adapted in this book, you adapted them for the modern cook. And,
right.
I mean, that's what's often so difficult when we source some of these old cookery books, is that the processes are difficult, if not impossible, to follow because, you know, we cook very differently today. And you've made it very easy for someone to try to recreate these recipes. And I thank you. Thank you so much for doing all this research. And I'm so glad that I discovered this book. And
me too.
And I encourage my listeners. I want to share it with them. Again, it's A Christmas Dinner, a story by Charles Dickens, and this is the 2008 version with recipes by Alice Ross. And I wish you all a very Merry Christmas and a wonderful, abundant Christmas dinner. And don't forget the Christmas pudding. Thank you, right. Alice.
Thank you very much.
And thank you for listening. Again, this has been A Taste of the Past, and I'm your host, Linda Palacio.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.
Listeners, we want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Aweli, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.